called kanos. Kanos is to be zealous. That means to stand up with a fiery enthusiasm for the cause of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the cause of mitzvos. But we also see from the story of Pinchas that if one's motivation is not out of love of a Jew, but one's motivation is out of anger, out of animosity, out of resentments, that could also have very, very destructive consequences, both to the character of the person that is doing it, and also in terms of even divine punishment. As the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh says, even when we engage in justifiable acts of violence, it does destroy us within, and it's like sticking your hands in fire. That's the primary lesson of Pinchas. But I just wanted to go through the fact that, you know, most people, when they learn the Parsha, everybody, if you look even in a Perush on Chumash, the vast majority of Divrei Torah are on the first five verses in a Parsha. No one ever looks into the rest of the Parsha. Even in a Gemara, yeah, if you look at a Gemara in any Yeshiva-based Medrash, you will find that the first few dafim are very well read. They're, you know, yellowed and used. When you get to the middle of the Masechta, no one ever gets to it. So I do want to share with you just some thoughts about the stuff that happens in the Parsha after the incident of Pinchas and the Bris Shalom. Just, if you have a chumash, just turn to that. Yeah, I'm trying to find it. Yeah, this is chapter 26, by Midbar chapter 26, in the Art Scroll, it's page 878. And the next thing that happens after the story of Pinchas, now remember, Pinchas stopped a plague that when Bilam tried to curse the Jewish people, and that curse was not successful, so Bilam gave Balak this spiritual advice, get the Jewish people to be promiscuous and turn to idolatry, and indeed the Jewish people did that. People were dying in a plague, 24,000 people died, the head of the tribe of Shimon was publicly fornicating with the Midianite woman, Pinchas came, he killed them both, in flagrante delicto, as we say, and as a result the Magepha stopped. Okay? And that is when Pinchas was given the covenant of peace. Now, if you look at Pasuk Chafav, it says, Vayihi acharei hamagefa. It was right after this plague had stopped, God told Moshe and Elazar, the son of Aaron, because Aaron already died, to go and count the Jewish people. Now, you know that the English name for the book of Bamidbar is, of course, the book of Numbers. And the reason why it's called the Book of Numbers is because most of the book is bracketed by a census. There is a census at the beginning of the Chumash, beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, and now there is a census here. But it's important to recognize that the census are counting two very different populations. The census at the beginning of the Book of Bamidbar is counting the Jews who left Egypt. Between 20 years old, anyone 20 and over who left Egypt. Now, that entire generation died during the 40 years of wandering in the desert. We're now in year 40. There is a new census. This census is no longer counting those who left Mitzrayim. This census is counting the generation of people who are going to be entering the land of Israel. Now, the amazing thing is that the sum total of the two sensei is basically almost exactly the same number. There are differences in tribes. Some tribes gained, some tribes lost. But taking into account all of the many deaths that did occur in the desert, it is remarkable that the population, more or less, is essentially the same. Now, what is the significance of a second census for the Bo'ei Haaretz? So here we get it, Bo'ei Haaretz means those who are entering the land of Israel. So here I just want to share with you a bit of a technical discussion, but it's interesting in terms of our own knowledge as to how the land of Israel was divided. Remember, these are the people who will be entering the land of Israel. Now there's a machlokas in the Gemara. How was the land of Israel divided? An attorney would say the question is per stirpes or per capita, but you'll see how this comes out. Was Eretz Yisrael divided in accordance with those who came into the land, Or was Eretz Yisrael divided in accordance with those who left Egypt? Let's give a concrete example. Let's say you have two brothers who left Egypt, a Reuven and a Shimon. Okay, Reuven and Shimon are brothers, they left Egypt. In the course of the desert, they died because they were 20 years old at the time of the sin of the spies. Now let's say Reuven has three sons, and Shimon only has one son. Okay, so you have three sons of Reuven, one son of Shimon. Now, there are two ways of imagining the way the land of Israel would be divided. If you divide the land of Israel according to those who left Egypt, that means Reuven gets a portion and Shimon gets a portion, meaning Reuven and Shimon, who are now dead, get equal portions of the land, and then it will be subdivided among their descendants, which would mean, in effect, that each of Reuven's children gets only one-third as much as the one child of Shimon. You see, because Reuven and Shimon get posthumously equal portions of the land, which is then subdivided to their descendants who enter the land. Right? So if Reuven's section is going to be subdivided in three parts, and Shimon's section is not going to be subdivided at all, right? So essentially, that means Shimon gets three times more than each of his cousins from Reuven's side. That is the opinion that says the land of Israel was divided according to those who, and the legal term for that is persterpes. Persterpes is a Latin term that means by the roots, meaning you go back to the roots of those who left Egypt, it's divided equally there, and then it gets subdivided among the grandchildren or children. The other interpretation of the Gemara is that Eretz Yisrael is divided not on the basis of those who left Egypt, but on the basis of those who directly entered the land of Israel. So consequently, if Reuven has three sons entering the land of Israel, there are three people who are making claims, and Shimon has one son that is entering the land of Israel, well, essentially everybody gets equal. If everybody gets equal, then each son of Reuven has an equal claim to Shimon, each son of Shimon, and therefore everybody gets equally. So that opinion takes the position that Eretz Yisrael was divided not on the basis of those who left Egypt, but Eretz Yisrael was divided on the basis of those who came into the land. But even so, it was somewhat restrictive, because those who came to the land mean those people who were at least 20 years old when they came into the land. Meaning to say, if you were a person below 20, again, if you were being raised by your parents, that's not a problem, but basically a person below 20 did not get an entitlement to a share of the land of Israel. They would simply inherit from their father when their father died, as it were, but there was no direct claim. Okay, so far I've given you two opinions. One opinion says Eretz Yisrael was divided on the basis of the people who left Egypt, which is called a persterpes division. And the other opinion says Eretz Yisrael was divided on the basis of those who entered the land, which would be called in modern legal terms a per capita, per head division, looking at people who actually entered. There is a third opinion, which is actually the halacha, and Rashi brings this, and unfortunately this is a bit complicated, in which the actual way the land of Israel was divided up is a composite of these two particular methodologies. And that is, we divide in accordance with those who enter the land of we divide in accordance with those who are entering the land of Israel, but we then have a posthumous inheritance on the basis of those who left Egypt. Now here's the actual example. Let's go back to that same example of Reuven and Shimon. Of course, these are bad names, really, because Reuven and Shimon didn't leave Egypt. They died before. But let's imagine you have a Reuven and a Shimon who left Egypt. And Reuven died in the course of the desert, and Shimon dies in the course of the desert. And what you have is, Reuven has three sons who are 20 years old, about to enter the land of Israel. And Shimon has one son who's 20 years old, who's about to enter the land of Israel. Well, we use the Boy Haaretz, we use the people who are going into the land to determine how many portions this group of people are going to get. This group of people are going to get four portions because we got three Reuven people and one Shimon people. But what we then do is, we then say that those four portions that go to this group of people should be treated as having belonged to the earliest ancestor they had who left Egypt, and it then goes down through inheritance. Meaning to say, Reuven's sons get three portions initially, Shimon's sons get three portions. But we then move the inheritance back as if it had belonged to Reuven and Shimon. But of course, that wouldn't change anything. If you just go back to Reuven and Shimon, what goes to Reuven is going to go down to Reuven's sons. But you go back to the earliest common ancestor, which we go back to a Yaakov. Let's say you have a Yaakov. Yaakov has a Reuven and a Shimon. Reuven has three sons. Shimon has one son. So there are four portions of land because there are four claimants. But then the Yerusha goes back all the way to a Yaakov. It's as if those four portions belong to Yaakov. Now let's imagine how that changes the picture. If those four portions belong to a Yaakov, then in effect, the posthumous inheritance is Reuven owns two, Shimon owns two, and then the two portions are divided three ways among Reuven's kids, and two ways among Shimon's one way among Shimon's kids. So it's apparent once again that Shimon's kid will get more than Reuven's. In other words, we don't have to go into all the details, but it is a, Rashi learns, it is a composite calculation in which the amount of the land is allocated based on the people coming into Israel, but then it is halachically regarded as if it belonged to the earliest common ancestor who left Egypt, and then it proceeds to be divided based on that inheritance line. Yeah.
And they still get three times as much.
No, let's see. It doesn't exactly work there, because what happens is... It goes back to Yaakov, so that means Reuven gets two pieces, Shimon gets two pieces. Yeah, that's correct. They get three times as much, but they also get much more land. In other words, if you were to simply go with the people who left Egypt, you would give Reuven one share, one piece, and Shimon one piece. And then that would be the one that's divided three ways for Reuven and one way for Shimon. But by using the four people to claim out how much land you get, you actually have four pieces of land that you're dividing that way. In other words, Reuven's kids only get one-third as much as Shimon's, but they both get twice as much land as they would have gotten had you gone the other way. Okay, that's the composite that Rashi follows, yeah.
But in actuality, Shimon went down by about half.
The population, yeah.
Shimon ended up with the smallest amount of land.
Let me explain that. Yeah, you're 100% correct, but the issue is that we're dealing with two different issues, meaning to say, the complicated thing I just sketched out was how was land divided within the descendants of a single tribe, meaning to say, it's a little misleading, my Reuven and Shimon were members of the tribe of Yisachar. Okay? Now, you are correct that intertribally, it was a very, very different situation because obviously if a tribe had fewer people, so the sum total of land allocated to that tribe would be less. But in terms of the per capita, what each individual walked away with, that would depend on this composite calculation. Okay, so with this particular background, again, it's important to know that the land was divided in a very peculiar way, in which you divided it in a number of sections equal to the generation that entered equal to the generation that's entering Israel, but then the Yerusha goes backwards and it comes down through the line of those who left Egypt, and it would be divided in a different way. So although the three descendants of the Reuven and the one descendant of Shimon together have four portions of land, but you would divide it based on inheritance from a common ancestor. And the Gemara goes to various psukim. But now we understand a little bit what the claim of Tzelophehad's daughters are. Right? Here we have a very important parsha where the daughters of Tzelophehad go to Moshe Rabbeinu and they say, "Hey Moshe Rabbeinu, our father died, our father has no sons. Why should we be deprived of inheriting a share in the land?" And Moshe did not know what the halacha was, and he asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that if a man does not have a son, his property should go to his daughters, and therefore the daughters of Tzelophehad inherited their father's property. I think I discussed that the daughters of Tzelophehad say a very peculiar thing. the daughters of Tzlafchad say, our father did not die in Korach's rebellion against God. Our father died because of his own sin. So once again, why is that? They seem to be bolstering their position by saying our father died because of his own sin. What's so wonderful about saying their father died because of his own sin? So if you remember, the Medrash says a remarkable thing. The Medrash says Tzlafchad was the guy who gathered wood on the Shabbos day. Remember, the Torah says there was a fellow who gathered wood on the Shabbos day. It doesn't give his name. And Moshe didn't know what to do with that one either. Apparently, the family of Tzlafchad creates many problems for Moshe Rabbeinu, which he doesn't know the answer to. Because he didn't know what to do with Tzlafchad, and Hashem had to say that you stone him. And then he doesn't know what to do with his daughters. But still, what is the significance of the fact that he says he died because of his own sin? So Tosfos in Bava Basra brings a medrash that says the following. Tzlafchad committed the sin of gathering wood on Shabbos for the sake of heaven. Because Jews thought, after it was decreed upon the sin of the spies, that the Jews would no longer enter Eretz Yisrael, many Jews thought, what is the purpose of keeping the Torah if we're not going to go to Eretz Yisrael anyway? So Tzlafchad deliberately sacrificed his life. He intentionally violated Shabbos, knowing that he would be sentenced to death, in order to reinforce upon the Jewish people that the Torah is binding even if you don't go into the desert. In other words, he committed a sin to be Mekadesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, and that is their meaning. He died not as Korach died, which was in an attempt to discredit Moshe and to denigrate the Torah, but Tzlafchad died because he had an intention to sanctify God's name. Okay, so that was the chait, that is L'shem Shemayim. Huh? Well, that's an interesting question. So the question is that suicide? Is there a difference between suicide and religious martyrdom? It's an interesting point. Well, let me give you another example that could raise the same question. We know that a Jew is supposed to violate the Torah rather than give up his life for almost every Avera, except for three big Averas. That's idolatry, Avodah Zarah, forbidden sexual offenses, and murder. Right? You don't murder to save your own life. Now, let's say a Jew were to decide, however, that even though his life is in danger, he would rather not eat kosher, not eat tray food, and as a result he dies. And he does so in order to sanctify God's name. Is that considered a virtuous thing, or is that considered a sin? Well, Maimonides writes very clearly that whenever the halacha says you are supposed to save your life and violate the Torah, and instead you go ahead and you want to be a tzaddik, and you don't violate the Torah, and as a result you die, Maimonides does write that is treated as a halachic suicide, and that's considered to be a very, very great avera. There's a story about Yaakov Kamenetsky when he was a rav in Lithuania. He had told an old sick person to eat on Yom Kippur. And when the person refused to eat on Yom Kippur and the person died, Rav Yaakov paskins that he's considered to be a suicide and you don't sit shiva for him. Very unusual, very, very strict. So by and large, you are correct. And we're not saying that Tzlafchad acted halachically proper. Presumably he acted halachically improper. We are saying, though, that his motives were good motives, meaning to say he is not deserving of the condemnation of Korach. A person who acts in a misguided way is not acting in an evil way, he's acting in an ill-informed way.
That's
right. The Chumash calls me Yeah, but it doesn't say, let's see what it says. It's in Shalach, right after the spies. Yeah, which pasuk are you looking at? Let's see. Seconds. Sheish. Yimsuesh. Which pasuk are you looking at?
It's not here.
Okay. Yeah, here it doesn't say, but indeed, you see, the daughters acknowledge he committed a sin. The daughters do say, Becheto Meis. He died for his sin. But nevertheless, it was a chet l'shem Shemayim. So I just want to just spend a few moments just to see the halacha about the laws of inheritance, because laws of inheritance, yeah.
I just want to ask regarding what you were just saying. What about the story, you know, I think a lot of people heard about it, of somebody in the Holocaust who the Nazis were playing games, they were, said, you know, eat this pork or we're going to shoot you, and he refused, and they shot him. What about in a case like that where it's a mamash war of annihilation for the Jews? Does it apply there?
Yeah, the Rambam says that if the purpose of the guy threatening you is to take you away from Judaism, to destroy your faith in God, then you must give up your life, even if it's for something less than the big three averis. In other words, there's a distinction between somebody who's starving and has to eat because otherwise they'll die, in which case you are not supposed to be strict, and a case where I say, eat this because I want you to reject the Torah or I'll kill you, in which case you are chayav to give up your life. So there is a difference in those particular cases. Meaning, eating because you're starving is different than eating because somebody says, I want you to reject the Torah in my presence. Yeah, one is called L'Havira al-Hadas, when I'm trying to take you away from Yiddishkeit. Be as it may, let's think for a minute about the laws of inheritance. And this raises an interesting legal question about, is a Jew allowed to make a will? A man dies. A man is married. Let's say a very simple case. A man has a wife. A man has a son. Well, let's make it even more interesting. A man has a wife, a man has two sons, and a daughter. And let's say the daughter is the youngest. What does the Torah say happens to the man's property? So the Torah says, Feirish, right? If a man dies without sons, then his daughter inherits, meaning if there are sons, the halacha is all of his estate goes to his sons, meaning his wife does not inherit his property, nor does his daughter inherit the property. All of the property goes to the sons. Again, we'll qualify that very, very shortly. Now, if one of the sons is a firstborn, not only does all of the property go to the two boys, but the one that is a bechor, the one that is the firstborn, gets a double portion. So, if a man dies and leaves an estate of $1 million with two sons and a daughter, wife gets zero, daughter gets zero, firstborn son gets $666,666, etc., right, $666,666.66, and the other son gets $333,333.33, right? That would be the division. That's her daughter. Now, it's important to understand, though, that this is not actually the way it works. And the reason is because although the estate is divided among the boys have certain obligations both towards their mother, towards the husband's wife, and towards their sister. And that is the following. This is an obligation of support. Let's take towards the widow first. Number one, according to halacha, the widow is entitled to free occupancy of the family home. So although the home in which she lived with her husband technically belongs to the sons in the two-thirds, one-third division, but she has a right of absolute occupancy until her death or until her remarriage, whichever comes first. That's one thing. That's the right of an almana, not a divorced woman, but an almana, a widow, to the family home. And number two, those children must support her out of their estate in the manner that she was accustomed to be supported when her husband was alive, the same standard. And if there's not enough to go around, meaning if the estate is not big enough to support her in that standard, unless they give her everything, then the halacha requires that they give her everything. So basically the idea was, although the sons inherit, the almana does have a right to the home and a right to that support. at whatever point, however, she gets married, those rights are going to terminate. Now, a similar rule is true for the daughter as well. That is, until the daughter gets remarried, she is entitled to be supported from the estate in the manner to which she was supported when her husband was, when her father was alive. And upon her remarriage, she is entitled to a dowry equal to 10% of the estate. Okay, this is at least a rabbinic law which is designed for the protection of daughters who don't inherit, and she gets a dowry of 10%. So let's figure out what that means. What does that mean if I have 10 daughters? Each one gets 10%, so there's going to be nothing left at all. So here the Gemara goes through a complicated calculation that the 10%, it's again very similar to a certain tax formula through depreciation, the 10% is 10% of a declining balance, meaning to say, you start off with an estate of $1 million. Daughter number one gets 10% of $1 million, which is $900,000. I'm sorry, 10% is, I'm sorry, 10% of $1 million is $100,000. Daughter number two gets 10% of the estate after you've taken off that 10%, which is 10% of 900, which is 90,000. Daughter number three gets, in other words, each time the 10% is calculated based on a declining balance as the daughters reach marriageable age. However, to then assure that all the daughters are equal, after you've figured out what each daughter gets, it's all put back in a common pot and divided 10 ways. In other words, so in effect, daughter number 10 is going to wind up with the same amount of money as daughter number 1. Because, let's take $2 just to make it simple. Daughter number one pulled out 10% of $1 million. 10% of $1 million is $100,000. Daughter number two is only going to pull out $90,000 because she only gets 10% of $900,000. Okay? But that doesn't mean we leave daughter number one with 100 and daughter number two with 90. That's not fair. But since collectively the two daughters have gotten 190,000, we put it back into a common pot, we divide it by two, and what is 190 divided by two? 95. So each one walks away with $95,000. Yeah.
What happens if they're spending, is this all determined right at the initial start of the settlement, or what if years later they've spent half, you know, the brothers have spent most of the money and there's only so much left?
It is a problem because there are two rights that a daughter has. One is to be supported, which starts right away, but the other is 10%, which is based on what they reach marriageable age, but the amount of their claim is based on the estate at the time of death. So they're in effect as a bill. They will owe her money in a case like this. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, that people sometimes have the misleading impression that under the halacha, the wife gets zero and the daughters get zero, when in fact there is a lot of substantial economic protection. But this brings us to the second question, which is really a practical issue I just want to discuss very quickly, and that is, according to Jewish law, is it permitted to make a will that provides for methods of inheritance that are at variance with what the Torah says the laws of inheritance are? If the Torah says the laws of inheritance are sons get and not daughters, sons get and not wives, or if you have just daughters and a wife, the daughters get and not the wife, etc., and you want to give your Yerusha to somebody else, you want to give all your Yerusha to one son, or you want all of your sons to be equal and not have the firstborn get a double portion, or you want to give your inheritance to charity, right? So the problem basically is this a violation of halacha, since the Torah sets out a Seder, an order in which there is inheritance and Yerusha. So here you have to understand the nature of the question. Meaning, let's assume I have a son and a daughter, and I provide in the will that I want my son and daughter to have equal. Now, if my son is happy with that, if my son, you know, loves his sister and has no problem with that, there is no halachic problem per se, because listen, if the son wants to share his inheritance, there's no problem. But here's where you have a problem. Let's say the son doesn't want his sister to have half. Now, in the eyes of Jewish law, when the father died, all of his property now belongs to his son. for the daughter to hold on to half of that property because of a will, when the Torah says that property belongs to the son, the question becomes, is she transgressing the Aveira of stealing somebody else's property? So that's really the issue. The issue of writing a will is not a significant issue if all the will does is express what the parents' desires are, and the parents voluntarily carry, I'm sorry, not the parents, the children, or whoever it is, voluntarily carry out what their parents want. So fine, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing that says a son cannot share with his sister. There's nothing that says a son cannot give everything back to his mother. That's perfectly fine. But the halachic issue about a will is when the halachic yoresh, the halachic heir, wants to assert his rights against the terms of a will. Is the beneficiary of a will allowed to hold on to that property, or is that a form of theft because it violates the ownership that the Torah... Our sons, the son's duty to support their sister out of the estate does not apply if she's a married sister. But if there's only a daughter, or only daughters, married daughters inherit the same as unmarried daughters. That's correct. So this is really a very, very big machlokas. We don't have time really to go through all of the different opinions. I just want to survey a few things very, very quickly. There are some opinions that say that a will can be validated even if it goes against the principles of inheritance because of a very general principle that applies in property matters that's called Dina de Malchusadina. Dina de Malchusadina is an Aramaic phrase that means the law of the government in civil matters is considered to be the law. Now, obviously, that cannot mean what it literally says. Right? If the government says you're allowed to eat treif, etc., you know, yeah, you can't do treif. If the government says work on Shabbos, you don't work on Shabbos. But this is a principle that applies to things like taxation. So if a Jew were to tax evade, not pay his taxes, that would be not only a violation of secular law, that would be a violation of Jewish law, because Jewish law requires that we obey the laws of the government when it concerns property matters and the like, and taxation. If a Jew were not to pay a minimum wage, that would be a violation of halacha. If a Jew were to violate the environmental regulations in operating a business, that would be a violation of halacha. So there are some poskim that want to validate a will, even over the objections of an heir, of a yoresh, on the grounds that wills can be subsumed under the principle of dina de malchusadina. Many, many other poskim very strongly object to the utilization of Dina de Malchusadina as a basis for invalidating the will for a lot of reasons. They say, first of all, Dina de Malchusadina primarily refers to my obligations towards the government. If I have to pay taxes, I can't evade my taxes. But in terms of how I deal with my children, my daughters, my brothers, and everything else, that has to be according to the Torah law. And consequently, a will is not something in which the government is directly involved. A will concerns how my property is distributed among private people. Now, how my property is distributed among private people is a matter of a Jew towards a Jew. A Jew towards a Jew, Dina de Malchusadina doesn't really work. So, consequently, according to those opinions, in order for a will to be halachically valid, you got to do something to make sure that it really takes effect before you die. Because as long as you're alive, you can give your property away, right? So you do something that says, this will shall take effect 1 second before I die. Because you see why? The laws of inheritance don't kick in until the person's dead. Anything you do before you die, you certainly have the right to do. In other words, if I have a son and a daughter, I could give property to my daughter before I die. That's not a problem. So you do it 1 second before your death, so technically it becomes something that is not contradicting the laws of inheritance because it takes effect a little early. Or if you do a trust would be, for example, I put the money in a bank account or something and I say, that it is for the benefit of my daughter, but I will continue to take the income until my death. In a case like that, you've already put it out of your estate by creating the trust, and that will be a way that a will could be created. So again, we don't have time to go into all of the particular details, but it's just important to realize that there's a major, major halachic question of whether wills can be written in contravention of the order of Yerusha, because that would be disposing of property in a manner that the Torah prohibits. The Poskim do say, however, that even if you make a will which successfully gets around these problems by making it 1 second earlier, there should be at least some of your estate that is allocated according to the Torah's formula. In fact, the minhag is that Jewish svarim, books, are distributed according to the Torah's formula, meaning to say the firstborn is supposed to get 2/3 of them, the sons get and not the daughters. In other words, there should be something in your estate that follows this particular idea of Yerusha.
Regarding the standard of living you're supposed to maintain for the both of them, should the daughter remarries and the widow remarries,
yep,
and it's someone who's poor or not,
yep,
close, can they make any claim saying, I'm not being supported the way I used to, can I want part of the estate conditions?
I hear it, but once they get married, they forfeited those claims. That's right. It's only until they get married. Okay. All right, so that was just one thing, and again, it's just a kind of a loose end, just to be aware of the fact that Parshas Pinchas is the Parsha that discusses both the mechanisms of how Israel was divided and the laws of inheritance generally. Let me leave you with one little other very, I won't call it a trivial pursuit question, because it is an important halacha, but kind of a unusual halacha that you can stump people with at a party or whatever it is. There are times in which a girl has greater inheritance rights than a boy. And here's the very interesting thing. Let's take a man, Reuven. Reuven has a son, and Reuven has a daughter. Reuven's son has a daughter, and Reuven's daughter has a son. Okay? Reuven dies, Reuven's son and Reuven's daughter dies. That's what they say. Reuven's son and daughter die first, then Reuven dies. So the only surviving heirs are the grandchildren, who are cousins. So ironically, the halacha is that granddaughter gets everything and grandson gets nothing. And the reason this is so is because the order of inheritance when Reuven dies is posthumous, meaning to say, people inherit in the grave, as it were, and then pass it on to their descendants. So consequently, the following. Reuven dies. Reuven had a son and had a daughter. His son and daughter are dead, but all of his inheritance passes to the son who is in the grave. Since his son only has a daughter, it then goes to his daughter. It doesn't go to his grandson, because his grandson came from Reuven's daughter, and Reuven's daughter got zero. So consequently, you have to look at it not in terms of the actual claimant, whether they're a boy or a girl, but to look at it in terms of the dead relative through which they are claiming. And therefore, the halacha is very clear that the son of a daughter gets nothing as compared to the daughter of a son, who will get everything. Right? So that's an example where the daughter will claim the entire inheritance and the son will get nothing in that case, because there's a posthumous inyan of Yerusha. Okay, so that's one thing that is discussed in Parshas Pinchas. And the next thing that is discussed, which is really the rest of the Parsha, and we read this every single Yom Tov, are all of the korbanos that are brought. These are the sacrifices that are brought, number one, daily, number two, on Shabbos, number three, on Rosh Chodesh, and number four, on all of the holidays, including Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. And these were the additional offerings that are called the Musafim, and they are brought on all the holidays, and that's why in the Maftir of every holiday we read the Musaf of Parshas Pinchas. In the Davening of Musaf we mention verses from Parshas Pinchas and the like. Now, the standard pattern of the Korban, Musaf, generally is the following. Let's say, for example, on Pesach. What was the Musaf for Pesach? So look for a moment in, this is on page 892 in the article, 893. And we're not talking about the Korban Pesach that every single Jew brought on the 14th of Nisan. We're talking about the communal Musaf, only one of which was brought on each day of Pesach. So look on verse 17, on the 15th day of the month is a festival. For a 7-day period, matzah shall be eaten. You shall offer a burnt offering, 2 young bulls, 1 ram, and 7 male lambs. Right. So the standard korban musaf was 2 parim, 1 ayel. An ayel is a ram. A ram is a male sheep, and 7 kvasim. Right. So this is the 2-1-7. This is the standard korban musaf for virtually all of the yamim tovim. And in addition, there was a goat that was a sin offering that was a kapara. The main and striking exception to this particular pattern. Now remember, these musafim were the same for every day of Pesach, all 7 days of Pesach, for Rosh Hashanah, for Shavuos, etc. The striking exception is Sukkos. Sukkos, we have a very unusual cheshbon with respect to the bulls that are brought on Sukkos. That Sukkos, the first day of Sukkos, you bring 13 bulls, the second day 12, third day 11, right, fourth day 10, etc. You keep on going down for 7 days of Sukkos, right? So it's 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. Sukkos is only 7 days. And the Gemara points out an interesting thing. Number one, the Purim of Sukkos equal the number 70. 13 plus 12 plus 11 plus 10 plus 9 plus 8 plus 7. And therefore, this represents the idea of the 70 nations of the world. There are 70 nations of the world, we are told, and the korbanos of Sukkos are korbanos on behalf of the 70 nations of the world. Why are we bringing korbanos on behalf of the 70 nations of the world? So there are two ways of looking at it. One way of looking at it is universalistic, and the other way of looking at it is rejectionistic. There are two different pshatim. One idea is that when Jews bring korbanos, they are not just bringing korbanos for the Jewish people, but they are bringing korbanos to bring blessing and compassion on all the nations of the world. And why bedatka sukkos? Because Sukkos is the time of harvest and ingathering. And we declare to God in gratitude for the harvest that we are grateful not only for the goodness that God shows the Jewish people, but we are grateful for the goodness that God shows all the people in the world. In fact, the Gemara says in Masechet Sukkah that if the nations of the world would know that the Jewish people pray for them in the Beis HaMikdash, they never would have destroyed it. They would have realized how much we owe the Jewish people. So one understanding of the 70 bulls is that it's a getter of prayer and offering on behalf of the nations of the world. That's explanation number one. But there is an explanation number two that says it's the opposite. That the 70 nations of the world represent powers of evil, powers of rejection, powers of exclusion, powers that try to block holiness from coming into the world. And our korbanos are designed to counteract the negative influences that the Umos HaOlam generate onto the world. And that explains the unusual feature of why the number of bulls diminishes. Why do you start off with 13, go down to 12, go down to 11? Because as we go further in our mitzvos, in our holiness, the powers of evil eventually get diminished further and further and further till they eventually reach the vanishing point. So you see, there are two opposite ideas. Is it the idea that you're asking God's blessing for the nations of the world? Or is the concept that you're trying to break their powers of evil and exclusion as time goes by? The emes is that there's a famous machlokas between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. How do you celebrate the lighting of the Chanukah menorah? Remember, Beis Hillel says, like we do, the first day you do 1, second day 2, third day 3, right? You go up. Beis Shammai says you go down. Now, Beis Hillel says you go up because you go up in holiness. Start off with one, you go up in holiness. But Beis Shammai says you go down, the Gemara says, because he draws a parallel between lighting Hanukkah candles and the Korbanos of Sukkot. Just like the Korbanos of Sukkot go down, the Hanukkah candles go down. So the question we might ask ourselves is, although it's not Hanukkah really, but just as a point, why does Beis Shammai compare Hanukkah candles to Sukkot? What does Hanukkah candles going down? As according to Beis Shammai, day one of Hanukkah, you light 8 candles. Day two of Hanukkah, you light 7 candles. And his prototype is Sukkot, where you go down. So the Sfas Emes says very beautifully, the Sfas Emes says, and this really ties into what we talked about with the menorah, that the menorah and the fire of the menorah is a symbol for the human soul that is a light of God that can generate holiness and wisdom if we protect ourselves correctly. But the machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is, what is this fire by which we perfect ourselves and give light? Beis Shammai views the imagery of fire as that which destroys and burns away. The Shammai says, you look at yourself, we look at ourselves, and we identify within ourselves flaws and inadequacies and lacks. So the way we perfect ourselves, says Beis Shammai, is we burn away one by one by one by one all of those flaws or inadequacies that are within our character. In other words, he looks at the metaphor of the human soul being a fire as a fire that can burn away those defects that need to be burned away. That's the metaphor of fire, that which burns that which needs to be destroyed. Consequently, in Beis Shammai's ideal human personality, what you do is, as you improve, you have fewer and fewer things you have to burn away. So day one, I got 8 things I got to get rid of. By day two, I only have 7 things I got to get rid of. So Beis Shammai, who views the process of human perfection as an honest and relentless gazing into the evil within us and surgically uprooting it one by one by one by one, his model of progress will be one in which the number of things you have to burn away is going to go down with time. And that's why he compares it with Sukkot, because that's exactly what the Korbanos of Sukkot are. In other words, the powers of the nations of the world gradually get diminished as we do more and more. The reason why Beis Hillel disputes the analogy is the following. Beis Hillel admits that if a person is really tough inside, if a person is really strong inside, they can look at their flaws honestly and objectively and just get rid of them, right? That's willpower. Just say no, as Nancy Reagan used to say. However, Beis Hillel says, realistically, we are often not strong enough for that. And realistically, as we confront our weaknesses and as we confront our averos, what is likely to happen in many cases is not that we will have the resolution to overcome them and go on, but rather we may be stuck in the mire of depression, of despair, of giving up hope, of feeling that we don't have the capacity to change, and as a result just stay exactly where we are or get worse. So Beis Hillel says, instead of viewing the metaphor of the candle as a metaphor of the fire that burns away the bad stuff, Beis Hillel says, let's concentrate on the warmth and light that we're able to generate. Meaning to say, instead of focusing on what is wrong with us, says, let us focus on the good things that we're able to do. And Beis Hillel's idea, and therefore the concept is, don't burn away the bad directly. Just add to the good. And consequently, his metaphor is, by adding to the goodness that you do, this automatically gets defeated. Meaning, you can't fight darkness directly. You can't take a stick and hit the darkness. But you fight the darkness indirectly by generating more lights. And therefore, by focusing on the good things that you're able to do, which gives you the spiritual strength to fight the things that are too hard for you. So the point is, Beit Shammai has the heroic tshuva of looking at our faults directly and burning them away. And hence the metaphor is, the fire goes down. And Beis Hillel has what is called the realistic model of tshuva. Sometimes you can't deal with all the bad stuff, but instead, do the good stuff. In other words, again, this is very, very practical. Let's say, for example, just to give you a very, let's take a simple example. Well, it's not a simple example, but it's a relatively simple case. A person is intermarried to a goy, okay? Now, and the person has begun to explore their involvement in Yiddishkeit. Now, you could sit down and tell the person, you know, you must, you know, just get rid of your wife, divorce your wife, etc., never see her again, etc. And this is done sometimes, and I know one particular case. The person is now, I don't want to say it's because of this, but the person basically became crazy and now he thinks he's Mashiach. He goes around different cities blowing shofars. And some have surmised this is because, in the course of his becoming a Baal Tshuva, he was immediately told that he has to leave his wife, never see her again, never talk to her again, etc. And he took that step, but he was never able to integrate it into his life, basically, and it drove him off the brink. Or a person is not yet ready to make the commitment not to work on Shabbos. Shammai might tell such a person, well, don't bother me now. You're not ready for tshuva, and if you're not ready to look at what you're doing wrong and eradicate it, Beit Shammai would say, you're not ready for tshuva, come back in 2 months. But what Beit Hillel would say in such a case is, okay, you're married to a goy, not a great thing. You're doing work on Shabbos, not a great thing. But why don't you make Kiddush before you go to work? Why don't you go to shul and hear Torah reading before you go to work? Why don't you have shalosh shuddos after you come home? Meaning to say, do the things that you're able to do. Create the light. And Beis Hillel says, the koach of a mitzvah builds up spiritual reservoirs of strength. It's something that I can't attack right now. But what I do is I do other things. But doing those other mitzvahs build me up. In other words, that's really the machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai says, you got to confront it directly and attack it. And that's the fire. Destroy it. Beis Hillel says, attack it indirectly by building yourself up in those other areas that don't create the frontal conflict. Because they did not celebrate the Sukkos holiday the way they would normally do it. Hanukkah was enacted as kind of a rabbinic replacement for the Sukkos festival that was not observed that year. This is what it says. Of course, we don't sit in the Sukkah, but it was kind of a celebration to make up for Sukkos. That is what it says in the book of the Maccabees. Well, there is no allusion to this in rabbinic literature at all, except perhaps in Beis Shammai's idea that the lighting of the Hanukkah candles is supposed to parallel the lighting of the bringing of the Karbanos HaSukkos. Maybe Beis Shammai is alluding to the idea that Hanukkah was a replacement for Sukkot that particular year. So it might be very interesting.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, see you tomorrow. Yeah.
Sorry, you know, it's the same time.
I think so, yeah.